The Bob Murphy Show, episode 48.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another solo episode of The Bob Murphy Show. I am, as you know, Bob Murphy. I'm going to apologize here on the front end. I have a cold I'm battling through. I was going to wait another day and see if it subsided, but then I'm going to get way too far behind schedule. So I'm just going to power through it, and hopefully you guys will just adjust and think, oh, this is a different kind of host. What I'm talking about today are the highlights from my article that recently came out in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. So the title of this article is More Than Quibbles, : Problems with the Theory and History of Fractional Reserve Free Banking. It comes in the volume 22, number one issue, and it's pages 3 to 25, so that's spring of 2019. Of course, I'll link to it at bobmurphyshow.com/48. And what I wanted to do in this episode is just hit some of the highlights here, because I know there's a lot of fans of the Austrian school, particularly in the Rothbardian tradition, that this issue is huge for them. And this is an area where I actually flipped. So when I was younger, when I was still, you know, hardcore Rothbardian, I actually was very sympathetic to the Selgin and White line, or position, let's call it, in the debates over fractional reserve free banking. Let me also say right now that the remarks I'm going to make here for this particular episode are going to assume that you, the listener, have a basic familiarity with this debate. If you don't, I refer you to the talk I've given at the last two or three, I'm getting losing track at this point, Mises Universities, where I go just I summarize the debate between Rothbardians and the so-called free bankers. And so I'll link to that, of course. If you haven't heard me talk about this and you don't really know what this debate is, it's best if you stop this right now and then first go watch or listen to the lecture I give at Mises U, because there I don't assume any prior knowledge. But for this one right here, since this is published in a journal, you know, we sort of took a lot of that groundwork for granted. And what I want to do here is, since I myself was surprised by some of the things I discovered over the last few years reading in this, and it's been a gradual process, so I can't remember exactly what made me flip over, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that I realized there was something, or I thought, people on the other side would say I didn't realize it, I thought that there was something screwy with fractional reserve banking, where when I was younger, I just thought, well, no, it's voluntary, it's fine. And so, and then as my own view on that changed when I went back and reread some of the stuff, especially by Salerno on this, I was like, oh, yeah, I totally see what he's saying now. So as far as the other prominent Austrians who write on this, Joe Salerno is probably the one that is closest to my own view right now. So in particular, what I mean there is, to me, the big issue is, does fractional reserve banking have something to do with the business cycle, the way that Mises and Hayek developed the theory of, or the so-called Austrian theory of the business cycle? And so I think it is intimately related, and I'm going to argue, and I do argue in this paper, that it's a natural outgrowth of the Misesian view. So a lot of what I do in this episode here is going to be documenting Mises' views on things. And so you might say, understandably, well, so what? Just because Ludwig von Mises said something doesn't mean it's true. And that's right. But especially if we're confining ourselves here to an intra-Austrian squabble, and this is notoriously one of the key areas where Austrians like to fight with each other, then it, to me, I think it is pretty relevant to say, what did Mises think? And also, what did Hayek think? Although with his writings, to me, it's not as clear. It, just as in general, I think Hayek, you know, over the course of his career, he kind of moved around a lot, said very brilliant things at times, but it was kind of hard to pin him down and to say, like, what did Hayek think about something? You might have to say, well, what period of his life are you talking about? Whereas with Mises, I think it's pretty crystal clear the line that Salerno takes. And so we'll flesh that out as we go through this. So without further ado, let's jump in here. So what I do in the beginning of the paper is just briefly mention that there were a lot of prominent economists who, at least at some points in their careers, favored some version of 100% reserve banking. And again, the point here isn't to say, ah, so it must be a good idea because these, but rather to defang a common criticism, which I hear virtually to this day when some economists or certainly internet commentators hear the Rothbardian or the, you know, Hoppian or Walter Blockian take on this, they just roll their eyes and scoff and say, oops, does Rothbard even know how modern banking works? What a more, you know, like that kind of reaction. And so that's the reason that I go out of my way to show that, no, actually people like Irving Fisher had a famous proposal in the 30s for 100% reserve banking because he thought fractional reserve banking had something to do with the, you know, the bank panics and so forth. I mean, he thought that would ensure financial stability. Milton Friedman apparently at one point in his career flirted with this. Even in modern times, Edward Prescott and his co-author advocated after the financial crisis of 2008-2009, a few years later at that Jackson Hole conference where monetary economists go, Prescott went and presented a paper on 100% reserve banking. All right. So this is not some nut job idea that only wacky Rothbardians have endorsed. Now, to be fair and to clarify, the rationale for each of those proposals could have been different in each case. So I'm not saying the reason, for example, Ed Prescott would have favored some version of 100% reserves is the same argument that Murray Rothbard would have given. But my point is just, if you have thought in your sampling of the internet debates on this, if you walked away thinking, yeah, it's just those quixotic Rothbardians who know nothing of legal history and apparently don't know the first thing about money and banking, go crack a textbook, dude. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, there are some people, even some professional economists, who have said things like that when they've just, you know, dismissed the 100% reservists as completely hopeless and bad economists on this. They've made remarks to that effect. And so that's why I'm now saying, what are you talking about? No, you can't dismiss it that flippantly. There are plenty of economists who have thought there's something disruptive about fractional reserve banking to the point where they've even considered legislative proposals that would limit it or even prohibit it outright. Even Mises and Hayek at various points have flirted with government prohibition on fractional reserve banking. Okay, Mises, it was in a, it's contained in the, so if you get the theory of money and credit, nowadays there's essays that get tacked on at the end that he wrote later. Like, so it wasn't part of his original 1912 paper or book, but essays he wrote later on monetary reconstruction that I think came out after World War II. Yeah, virtually certain. And so in there, Mises has an essay about, well, how do you, you know, go back on the gold standard and ensure sound money again? And he does have a thing in there talking about, well, you gotta say that for banks to issue new dollars at this point going forward, the new issue of dollars has to be backed up one for one with the proper amount of gold. So that's not insisting on 100% reserves, but that means, you know, insisting on the new issues are themselves backed up by 100%. Okay, so I'm not saying that's Mises' definitive position that we should think of that as the Misesian take on it, but my point is, at various points, even Mises flirted with that sort of policy. All right, so other thing too, before I get into this too deeply, the reason I call it More Than Quibbles, that's a nod to Baggus and Howden have a 2010 paper where they bring up what they call are some quibbles with fractional reserve banking. And I amplify one of the particular quibbles that they have. And in my view, these aren't quibbles. Like, these are pretty devastating objections that I'm bringing up here in my paper. And so that's why I'm saying this is more than quibbles, guys. And I think Baggus and Howden were just, you know, sort of being gentlemanly there with their language. All right. So One of the key quotes here that I think is pretty definitive comes, and this comes up a lot in the debates. And so the 100% reservist Austrians will quote this and trumpet it and say, ha ha, there you go. And then, you know, the other side will try to minimize it, or they'll bring up other quotes to try to put it in context. But it comes from a footnote, and this is in Human Action, where Mises is talking about credit expansion. And then he says in this footnote, the notion of normal, and normal's in quotation marks, the notion of normal credit expansion is absurd. Issuance of additional fiduciary media, no matter what its quantity may be, always sets in motion those changes in the price structure, the description of which is the task of the theory of the trade cycle. All right, let me just read that one more time, because I know if you're driving, that might have been tricky. Mises, you know, has a real flowery German-esque language here, but I'll read it again. The notion of normal credit expansion is absurd. Issuance of additional fiduciary media, no matter what its quantity may be, always sets in motion those changes in the price structure, the description of which is the task of the theory of the trade cycle. Okay, now in fairness, he then goes on to say, of course, if the additional amount issued is not large, neither are the inevitable effects of the expansion. Okay, so to me, that is the Salerno now slash Murphy position, that whatever else you want to say about fractional reserve banking, the point is its existence is what causes the boom-bust cycle, right? So Mises had what he called the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. That was the phrase he used for, but that's now what we call Austrian business cycle theory. Okay, so Mises is saying any issuance of additional fiduciary media, and again, fiduciary media means claims on money that banks issue that are not backed up by actual money proper in the vault. So engaging in further fractional reserve banking always sets in motion the trade cycle. But then Mises' point, when he, you know, goes on with that last sentence, is to say, of course, if there's not too much of the fiduciary media being issued, then it's not going to be a very big trade cycle. It's not going to be a big deal. Okay, so to me, that's that little footnote, even though he said, it's a footnote, who cares? But to me, that really crystallizes the whole Misesian position. And that's the point that Salerno has been making in his writings on this. And that's the point now that I'm trying to amplify as well. And there's a lot of places where it looks like Mises keeps vacillating back and forth. Oh, gee, in this passage, it seems like he's for free banking. In this passage, what's going on? And I think that sentence or that quotation there really explains what's going on. And again, I credit Joe Salerno for raising this possibility. And once I had this in mind, I went back and reread the quotes from Mises. Virtually all of them fit nicely into this new explanation. Okay, so for the backdrop here, especially if you look at the theory of money and credit, it looks like there's different considerations going on. And so if you want to say, hey, Ludwig von Mises thinks fractional reserve banking is great and it's a good thing for humanity, you can go find some quotes where he seems to be saying that. And if, on the other hand, if you want to say, no, Mises thought it was a real destabilizing influence on the economy or the financial sector, you can go find plenty of quotes where he's saying that. And it's, geez. And then if you want to find Mises praising, quote, free banking, he does that in several places, even in Human Action. And so it's like, man, it looks like Mises was all over. And, you know, it's kind of like the Bible where different factions or sects can quote whatever passages they want for their position. And what I'm saying now is that, no, after reading what Salerno's explanation was, I think it's a good one, that the places in Human Action where Mises is praising free banking, he's praising it because he thinks institutionally that's the best way we can limit fractional reserve banking, that it's through the competitive process in the banking sector where new people can open up new banks. And if any one bank expands too rapidly, then its reserves get quickly drained to its peers that haven't expanded so rapidly. And so as long as there's not a cartel that's being fostered, especially by a central bank, you would expect normal competitive forces to keep the banks having relatively high fractional or reserve ratios, I should say. So they might not have 100%, but I take Mises to be arguing practically that's the best we can do. Because if we were to entrust the state with the important task of limiting fractional reserve banking, Mises thinks you couldn't trust it to do that, that it would you'd end up regretting that. Like if next time there's a big war, for example, then the state would just relax those constraints and let the banks issue a lot of new money in order to finance the war effort. Okay, so Mises' point is rather than trusting the state to prohibit fractional reserve banking, just allow a regime of so-called free banking, by which Mises just meant you don't have any special regulations on the banking sector. That's just banks are just like a normal business like anything else. And if they violate their contracts, okay, well, then they can be prosecuted in the normal court system. But there's nothing special about running a bank. And Mises thought that the competitive pressures in that system would limit the issuance of fiduciary media. Okay, so there's not a conflict there. But when Mises is praising free banking and human action, you should not assume that that means he's endorsing what today's free bankers write on the topic. All right, so here in this podcast, I'm not going to provide quotes to justify that. I'd give a little bit in my paper, and then I cite Salerno, where he tries to make the point, you know, he elaborates more on it than I do. So I'm not here trying to convince you of it if you're skeptical. I'm just, what I'm doing is raising the possibility. Because again, I remember when I was younger, I had concluded it when reading both sides of this debate, and they were each providing quotes from Mises. I remember walking away thinking, wow, yeah, Mises isn't really helpful on this. He's all over. And now I realize, no, he wasn't contradicting himself left and right. It was, again, I think what he was saying is he was consistent in that, yep, issuing fiduciary media always sets in motion the trade cycle. But hey, if you could constrain the issuance of fiduciary media, it's not that big a deal. In the regime of free banking would constrain them the best that we can hope for in this fallen world, right? So I think that's what his position was. And certainly, I mean, just put it this way, it would be weird if Mises contradicted himself in the same book, right? It's one thing if his views evolved over time, but the quote that I just read to you, the footnote where he says the notion of normal credit expansion is absurd, any amount of fiduciary media causes the trade cycle, that's in Human Action. And Human Action is also where he praises free banking in several places. So it would be weird if Mises contradicted himself in the same book. Like, you know, didn't he catch, especially because it went through multiple editions, did nobody bring up to him, hey, how come you're contradicting? So I think that bolsters Salerno's interpretation there, where Mises, when he praises free banking and Human Action, is not saying, ah, yes, I think that, you know, the mechanism that later guys like Selgin and White will detail through which banks issue additional fiduciary media based on the desires of people in the market is a good thing, and that's equilibrating. I don't think he would agree with that. Now, what I do in this paper that I don't think anyone else has done is I try to give more context as to why Mises would think what he just wrote in that little footnote that I quoted for you. Okay, so because to me, this is really key. If you can understand Mises' view of the business cycle and what causes it, then you'll see why that's not just some idiosyncratic view where Mises had said there any fiduciary media or any credit expansion causes the business cycle. That when you understand what Mises thinks causes the business cycle, then it's crystal clear as to why he would obviously conclude credit expansion per se causes it. Not merely credit expansion fostered by government intervention, right? Because that's the position of people like Selgin and White. So they're against central banking, right? They understand that there's such a thing as too much credit expansion. They're just saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. They're saying, yeah, get rid of the central bank, get rid of special privileges, you know, FDIC and stuff like that, and bailouts. But given that it's a genuine free market, and that there's penalties if you violate contractual obligations, like if you said you're going to be able to redeem your bank notes and you can't, and then you know you should be punished. There can't be a quote bank holiday like FDR allowed for, things like that. But their point is the market equilibrium, profit maximizing reserve ratio might be well below 100%. And they think that they have historical and theoretical reasons for why that should be so. Okay, so for them, a quote, normal credit expansion justified by market fundamentals isn't absurd. They think, no, that's a good thing. And it would be wrong. We would be leaving potential prosperity on the table, as it were, if we foolishly insisted on 100% reserve ratios for our banks in a free society. All right. So I'm now trying to show why Mises would disagree with that. And when you understand his deeper thoughts about the business cycle, to me, it jumps right out. And so that's why I spend time in my paper here, the one that just came out, exploring Mises' views on the business cycle. And what I did is I mentioned to the reader, many people might not know this, and I know it because I wrote the study guide for Human Action and for Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. And so when you go to write study guides like that, you know, you're just looking at the layout of the book and the table of contents. Like, I was seeing the scope of the book. Like, I understood why Mises arranged the book, you know, Human Action, the different components, the way he did. And it just, it forces you, and also because I wrote Choice, and so I had to reread the book again and think about the layout and, you know, which chapters am I going to stress and what am I going to gloss over, things like that. But just the organization of the book jumped out at me more. And so one big difference between Man, Economy, and State and Human Action is that when they're giving what we call Austrian business cycle theory, Rothbard puts it in the section where he's talking about interventionism, right? So when Rothbard has the section of Man, Economy, and State just talking about the pure market economy, he doesn't have the business cycle in there because for Rothbard, you need the state to be intervening in order to cause a business cycle. Whereas Mises doesn't do that. Even though Mises does have the Human Action separated into sections where it first deals with the pure market economy and then later dealing with the consequences of government interventionism, he deals with what, you know, would be called the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle, or we'd call Austrian business cycle theory. He deals with that in the pure market economy section. And so let me just read, this will be a little bit long, so bear with me, folks, but I'm only reading this because I think it's very relevant. Okay, so again, so this is Mises talking about why is it that he is putting his treatment of the business cycle in the section dealing with the pure market economy rather than his later sections where he's going to deal with interventionism. You know, things like the minimum wage law or sales taxes or things like that, right? So later, you know, foreign exchange controls, Mises will deal with that later in the book, but he's here dealing with the trade cycle. And so he's acknowledging to the reader that one might have thought I would defer this till later, but no, I'm doing it right now. When I walk through why is Mises doing it here, that sheds light, in my opinion, on his views on fiduciary media and the trade cycle. Okay, so this is Mises. This is a bit long, but I think it's very relevant to this debate. It is beyond doubt that credit expansion is one of the primary issues of interventionism. Nevertheless, the right place for the analysis of the problems involved is not in the theory of interventionism, but in that of the pure market economy. For the problem we have to deal with is essentially the relation between the supply of money and the rate of interest, a problem of which the consequences of credit expansion are only a particular instance. Everything that has been asserted with regard to credit expansion is equally valid with regard to the effects of any increase in the supply of money proper. As far as this additional supply reaches the loan market at an early stage of its inflow into the market system. Okay, so I'll stop there. I have longer quotes here, or I quote more in the paper, but I'll stop there because of the different medium here. But I think that's really the crux of it, right? So what Mises is saying is, yes, credit expansion is a primary issue of interventionism. The political system is what fosters credit expansion, and that's in practice what causes the boom-bust cycle. And that's why, you know, normally you might associate the boom-bust cycle with political interventionism. But he's saying the actual underlying mechanics of it, as an economist, when I'm explaining to you how is it that credit expansion causes the business cycle, notice that the mechanism I'm using, everything I've said there would also apply if, theoretically speaking, money proper increased, the supply of money proper increased and hit the loan market before it worked its effects in all the other sectors of the economy. Okay, so practically speaking, to make sense of what Mises is talking about here, imagine a society that uses gold as money, like just gold coins, let's say. Like, people are walking around, they're going into shops, giving merchants actual gold coins. And then there are banks that issue paper notes that say the owner of this note, if he goes to any of our branches, can present it, and upon demand, he will be given, you know, a gold coin. And those banks engage in fractional reserve banking, right? So they periodically issue more paper tickets than they have actual gold coins in the vault. Well, that's credit expansion, and that can cause the boom-bust cycle. But what Mises is saying here is, hypothetically speaking, if there was a huge discovery of new gold, and if the people who got their hands on that gold relatively early in the process went and lent it out and pushed down interest rates before, you know, that new gold circulated around and everybody just got used to it and prices adjusted, blah, blah, blah. If one of the first sectors to be hit were the loan market by that new influx of gold, money proper, then that would also set in motion a boom-bust cycle. Right? So Mises disagrees with Rothbard on that point. Rothbard thinks, no, in a genuine market economy, if everything's voluntary, an influx of gold doesn't cause a business cycle. So my point here isn't whether that's right or wrong. I'm just saying, since Mises thinks that, to me, that's why it's so obvious that his earlier statement in the footnote where he said any credit expansion necessarily causes the boom-bust cycle, right? Because he's thinking of it as, oh yeah, when new money enters the loan market first, it changes the prices there, and those are out of whack relative to all the other prices in the economy. So here, this is, I don't know if Mises himself thought of it as an example of this, but if you've heard of what's called Cantillon effects, then this is, I think, is an example of that, right? So the idea is, if the government runs the printing press and spends new money on some military hardware, the prices there get bid up first, and then the stockholders and the employees for that firm or that sector have more money in their pockets, and they go around and they start spending it. And so the price hikes from the new influx of money sort of ripple through the economy. It's not that if the quantity of money goes up 10% because of the inflationary purchases, that the price level just rises uniformly 10%. No, the price hikes go sporadically around the economy. They ripple from place to place. All right. And so likewise, if the new money enters the loan market, if that's the vehicle through which it enters the economy is through loans, Mises is saying, yep, hypothetically speaking, that could cause a boom-bust cycle. Now, he goes on to explain why, in practice, credit expansion via the banks is far more likely to cause a boom-bust cycle than influxes of gold from new mining. And it has to do with, number one, the production or discovery of new commodity money typically is always going to be a small fraction of the existing supply or existing quantity, right? So there's that element, whereas it's a lot easier if banks are issuing money, they can issue a lot more relative to the existing stock, technologically speaking, than gold miners can bring to the table. So that's one element. And then the other difference is, if new money, in the broader sense, is created by banks issuing fiduciary media, all of that influx comes in the economy through the loan market, right? By its very nature, when fiduciary media is created, the first people that get their hands on that newly created money are the people who borrow it. Okay, so 100% of fiduciary media enters the economy via the loan market. And so it pushes down interest rates more than any other type of money creation, you know, whereas if the government just ran the printing press and used newly printed fiat dollars to pay Lockheed for new jets or whatever, that wouldn't cause the boom bust cycle as much as Bank of America issuing more fiduciary media, right? Because not all of that newly printed fiat dollars to buy military hardware is going to go through the loan market. It's going to start affecting other prices as well right away. Okay. Likewise, if there's some new discovery of gold and now a bunch of people in the community all of a sudden have a bunch of new gold in their pockets, they're going to go on a spending spree, but they're probably not going to take 100% of that new discovery and go lend it out. They're probably going to go to the saloon. They're going to buy their significant other's nice presents. They're going to go buy sports cars, whatever. Maybe they'll lend out a bunch of it or invest a bunch of it. And so it'll distort credit markets, but not all of it. And so Mises is saying, for those two reasons, that's why in practice, he's not sitting up at night worrying about new gold discoveries causing massive boom-bust cycles. But he's saying, strictly speaking, the theoretical mechanism or the way he as an economist handles how is it that credit expansion causes the business cycle, he's saying, yes, in theory, a large enough discovery of gold for which a big fraction of the new gold hit the loan market first or relatively early, that would cause the boom-bust cycle too.
All right.
Let me, now that I've paraphrased and elaborated on what he meant, let me just go ahead and reread those that passage from Mises, because I think it'll make more sense to you now that I've explained what he's saying. So again, Mises is explaining here, why is it that I'm covering the boom-bust cycle or the theory of that in the section on the pure market economy, and I'm not deferring it to the section of human action where I talk about interventionism. It is beyond doubt that credit expansion is one of the primary issues of interventionism. Nevertheless, the right place for the analysis of the problems involved is not in the theory of interventionism, but in that of the pure market economy. For the problem we have to deal with is essentially the relation between the supply of money and the rate of interest, a problem of which the consequences of credit expansion are only a particular instance. Everything that has been asserted with regard to credit expansion is equally valid with regard to the effects of any increase in the supply of money proper, as far as this additional supply reaches the loan market in an early stage of its inflow into the market system. Okay, so again, there he's talking about the supply of money and the interest rate. And so what he's saying there is the new money, if it hits the loan market relatively early, it's going to distort the interest rate. It's going to push the interest rate below its, quote, natural level. And that's what's going to cause entrepreneurs to make faulty investments, to make malinvestments. That's what causes the unsustainable boom, which then necessitates the eventual bust. Okay, the interest rate ends up being wrong. And since in the Misesian framework, the correct market rate of interest has a job to do, it helps coordinate saving, the preferences of the consumers for longer or shorter production processes and what the entrepreneurs are investing in. The interest rate is a key price that facilitates all that or coordinates all that. So if it's wrong, if it's artificially low, that's not doing the economy any favors, right? In a Keynesian framework, if the interest rate's too low, oh, that boosts output, but it might cause unwanted price inflation. And that's kind of the bad thing is, oh, it makes the economy overheat, whereas in the Austrian framework, things are much more complex and there's this whole underlying physical capital structure. And so an artificially low interest rate, it's not just, ooh, the economy might be producing too much in some sense. It's producing the wrong things. Entrepreneurs are starting long-term projects, not all of which can be completed because there's not enough real savings available. And so for a while, things seem good, but eventually, just physically, the economy is not capable of continuing all these different projects that were started. And then that's what manifests itself as the crisis. And a bunch of entrepreneurs slapped their heads and realized, ooh, we were too optimistic. We shouldn't have done this. We got to start laying people off and scaling back. And that's when the bust ensues. Okay, so again, if it's artificially low interest rates that are the problem that caused the unsustainable boom, I think it's pretty clear here that Mises is saying, matter-of-factly, yeah, it's when new money enters the economy and hits the loan market relatively early, that's what causes this problem. He says the theory of the trade cycle has to do with the supply of money and the rate of interest. Okay, so since he's saying that, I think it's crystal clear why he earlier said there's no such thing as normal credit expansion. Any amount of fiduciary media causes those effects that we handle under the theory of the trade cycle. All right, so to me, that's all Salerno has been arguing, and that's not what I'm arguing when I say, like in my debate with George Selgin that we had at the Soho Forum, that was my position, that fractional reserve banking per se causes the business cycle. Now, of course, if it's kept really limited, then it's not going to be a big deal empirically. But so it's true if we had, and this is, I guess this is a secondary issue, is to say, well, what do you want to do about it? What's your policy conclusion? So no, I'm not for the political authorities putting all kinds of stringent regulations on the banks. I'm for, quote, free banking. I mean, I'm a philosophical anarchist. So I don't think there should be a federal government at all. And so from that sense, yeah, I don't want the government putting in reserve requirements either. But as to, and we could talk about what would happen in a free society, I do think market forces would hold banks to very high reserve ratios. And also, this is just a little side comment here, I'll move on. I think in practice, what might end up happening is there would be actual 100% reserve demand deposits, but people would have them be a small portion of their portfolio. So the stuff that Selgin and White refer to as fractional reserve checking accounts, I think something like that might exist. It's just, I would say, well, no, that's not really a demand deposit. Okay, so some people might say, oh, you guys think the same thing and you're just quibbling over semantics. I don't think it's semantics, though. Like I say, I mean, it's with Mises. Here, I'm going off on another little tangent here. Mises talks about why is it, I think I get into this in the paper a little bit. He had to make a decision in the theory of money and credit with his definitions and his classifications. Because if you define money as a commonly accepted medium of exchange, well, superficially or prima facie, that looks like banknotes. You know, fiduciary media should qualify as that because they're commonly accepted and they're a medium of exchange. But Mises thought, no, there's something real subtle going on here. And so that's why he distinguished between money in the narrower sense and money in the broader sense. Okay, so for Mises, commodity money is money proper, money in the narrower sense, whereas airtight claims that nobody doubts to get money delivered to you at par upon demand, that's what Mises called a money substitute. And then if it was backed up, he called it a money certificate. And if it wasn't, it was fiduciary media. All right. So, and he called that money in the broader sense. So notice there, he's, by calling it money in the narrower versus broader, he's acknowledging you could, with justification, refer to all of this as money. But he thought it's not, in order to really understand what's going on in the modern financial system, you need to make a distinction between money proper versus claims on money that circulate and are just as good as claims on money. So notice that that's really the issue, that the reason fiduciary media have such power to disrupt things is that they are just as good as money insofar as the community accepts them at par with money. So the fact that you can go into the grocery store and if your bill is $100, you can either give them five $20 bills or you can swipe your debit card, which really is just like your bank saying, okay, now we owe you $100, grocery store, rather than, you know, the customer who is our client. In one sense, those aren't the same things, right? It's just Bank of America promising that if you want it, we'll give you five $20 bills. But in practice, because the grocery store has no doubt that Bank of America will be good for that, that's why they let you go ahead and buy your groceries either way. Whereas if you pulled out like a stamp collection and said, no, Google, look at these things are worth $100. Go ahead. They probably wouldn't take it. And or if they did, like if they called a manager over, he might do it at a huge, you know, discount because of the hassle. Or if you tried to pay with foreign currency or something. All right. So that's really the essence of it. And so when you walk through and see Mises' considerations that he goes through in the theory of money and credit as to how to classify these different things, and what do I mean by fiduciary media and that kind of stuff, and commodity money and money proper and money substitutes and things like that. This was all in order to explain, or because he thought you needed to make those distinctions for his trade cycle theory. And so that's why I'm going back now to say, I don't think it's merely a semantic, you know, quibble here, that it really does matter that if the community thinks certain things are just as good as money in practice, regardless of what the legal justification is. And by the way, Mises gets into that stuff too. You know, Mises says, I don't care if, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, Mises doesn't talk this colloquially, but Mises is saying, it doesn't matter if the banks technically have the option to, you know, reserve or to suspend payment and stuff like that. If the community treats these banknotes as being redeemable upon demand, then that sets in motion the trade cycle. If, you know, if the banks issue more of these things than they have actual coin in the vaults. All right. So again, a lot of stuff that Selgin and White get into historically, look at this thing and they had the legal return. And in a free society, we can imagine contracts and blah, blah, blah. I'm saying it's if the community is treating these claims as being interchangeable with the actual base money, then that gives rise to the business cycle that Mises developed. So it's not a question of, is this legal or not, or is this fraud? That's kind of a secondary issue. And I'm not taking a stance on that one way or the other. All I'm saying is that is irrelevant as far as the trade cycle stuff goes. Okay, the next big topic here I want to cover is Selgin has a a nice argument that he lays out in several places where they try to take on the claim that it's disequilibrating, right? The issuance of fiduciary media, because the argument from the 100% reservists goes like this. The 100% reservist will say, look it, yeah, we understand you've got your theory about money demand, and if there's a sudden increase in the demand to hold money and prices are sticky, blah, blah. But by catering to that, by creating new money that flows through the credit sector, through the credit markets, fractional reserve banking, even if we stipulated for the sake of argument that, yeah, the economy, quote, needs more money because people want to hold more, and that it might alleviate the frictions if more money could flow from the banks rather than having to go to the trouble of digging up more gold or just waiting for prices in general to come down in this grinding deflationary process. Wouldn't it be great if we could just satisfy the increased demand to hold money by the banks just electronically issuing or, you know, printing up paper notes, bank notes? And even if we stipulated that, the 100% reservists argue, the fact that it flows through the credit markets is the problem. That at best, you're satisfying that imbalance of money, demand, and supply by screwing up the credit markets, because you're necessarily, by advancing more loans, because that's the way the new banknotes get into the economy, right? The bankers aren't just hiring a helicopter and just dropping banknotes as gifts. They're lending them into the economy. And so that's going to necessarily push down interest rates. And so the point is, how can that be the correct interest rate, right? You're going to set in motion the boom bust cycle. That, so that's what the 100% reservists claim. Even if we agree that, yeah, there's such a thing as sticky prices, and we can imagine scenarios where there's an inadequate quantity of money or there's an excess demand for money, blah, 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 the way like somebody like Yeager would have described. Even so, if the free bankers want to deal with that by allowing banks to come in and issue new money, there's a problem. It's going to set in motion the boom bust cycle, right? So that's what the 100% reservists might say. And of course, they might also quibble with the whole sticky price stuff too. I'm not conceding that, but I'm just saying, even if you did concede it for the sake of argument, that's still, according to this, you know, people like in the Salerno or now Murphy view, you're still having this problem of, okay, but if that new money flows into the economy through the loan market, you're going to have the wrong interest rates are going to be artificially low while that new credit is flowing through. And that's where the business cycle comes from. So Selgin had a very clever way of dealing with that to try to defang that argument. And so briefly, he argued, and he didn't invent this position. He, you know, quoted from other people and so on, but he put it very succinctly. And he argues that no, because in a regime of free banking, you know, not backed up by government cartels and things like that, but in a genuine open market of free banking, the way that Selgin or Larry White describes it, if you study the conditions under which it's profitable for banks to lower their reserve ratios, then that will only happen when people in the community want to, on net, hold more banknotes. Okay, so it's not a matter of the banks just out of nowhere deciding to issue more loans, but rather it's that the community wants to hold more banknotes, and that's what changes the considerations, the calculations of individual banks when they decide, should we issue more fiduciary media or not, right? Because they don't have reserve ratios of zero, right? So even if you just have, you know, no limits and banks can do whatever they want, they're going to settle down into an equilibrium where they're going to say, okay, if we were to offer more unbacked banknotes in order to earn more interest in terms of volume, like the price would have to drop, but issuing more, you know, they have more total loan volume, That's why a bank would want to engage in fractional reserve banking, because they make more money. But at some point, the bank gets nervous and says, "I know if we pushed it even further, if we lowered our reserve ratio below what it is right now, then the chance of so many redemptions being, you know, just in the normal clearing process and banks presenting our notes to us and we present their notes to them and we just, you know, settle up at the end of the week or whatever it is, if we issue too many unbacked banknotes to people who borrow from us, as they spend those in the community, those are ultimately going to find their way back to us in our reserves in the vault of the money proper, whether it's gold or something else, you know, we might get drained too low or we might actually run out." So that's why the banks, and any individual bank, has a profit maximizing reserve ratio in a free banking regime. All right. And so what Selgin is arguing is he's saying, if you go ahead and run those calculations in a free banking regime, if the communities, the only reason the banks would all issue more fiduciary media is that the public's appetite, its willingness to hold more banknotes has increased. And that's what would make the banks decide to lower their reserve ratio. And so far from, and yes, it's true, Selgin says that would mean other things equal, that the rate of interest drops. But he's saying that's what you want to have happen. Because, he argues, the fact that someone in the community is now willing to add another banknote to his holdings is implicitly him granting a loan to the bank that issued it. Because the person could, if he wanted to, turn that banknote over, you know, let's say it's Bank of America. So he's got a thing saying the holder of this note can present it to any Bank of America branch and get 1 ounce of gold. And the fact that from last week to this week now, someone in the community is willing to hold one more of those notes in his possession and not redeem it. So on net, he now holds more cash holdings. And, you know, if cash is construed in the broader sense, then Selgin's arguing that person has implicitly granted a loan of 1 ounce of gold to Bank of America. Because just like Selgin's saying, imagine if he originally started out with an ounce of gold, like the actual coin, yellow coin, and he went to Bank of America and deposited it. And then Bank of America just added it to his checking account and said, okay, there it is on deposit. And then the person said, okay, you keep it for now. Selgin's going to say that's like the guy is lending the gold coin to Bank of America. And every day that he keeps it in there and doesn't spend it, he has rolled over that loan. You can think of it as very short-term loans, like a, you know, minute-to-minute loan if you want. And every minute that he refrains from spending it and that gold coin is in his checking account balance, the man is lending that gold coin to Bank of America. So likewise, if the guy didn't start out with the gold coin but just received a banknote in commerce, but decided just to hang on to it rather than redeem it for the actual gold coin, then that's effectively the same thing, that he has implicitly granted a loan to the issuing bank. All right. And so even though when the banks decide, hey, because market conditions have changed, we find it profitable to lower our reserve ratios and issue more banknotes, and the borrowers are, you know, entrepreneurs, like somebody who wants to expand his factory. So he says, oh, the rate of interest went down. So now at these new interest rates, it makes sense for me to expand my factory. And so he goes and takes out a business loan. And then he buys lumber and hires workers. And those banknotes that were newly created on the printing press circulate around the community. But the bank was only willing to do that if now they like sort of end up as reservoirs in the pockets of various people around the community who do not turn those notes back in to get the gold coins, right? So that's the critical thing here, that the banks, if they're correct, you know, if they correctly ascertain the new market conditions and realize, oh yeah, we can, quote, get away with issuing more banknotes and we're not going to have our reserves threatened. People aren't going to show up next Thursday with extra notes draining our reserves of gold coins in the vault. Well, then everything's fine. And so Selgin's point is that's not disrupting the loan market, that's equilibrating. Because what ended up happening is implicitly the people who are willing to hold on to those extra banknotes, they are the ones that effectively lent money to the entrepreneurs who borrowed at the lower interest rates and expanded their factory. So it's wrong, Selgin says, for the 100% reservists to look at this as a situation of the banks creating money out of thin air and injecting it in the loan market in letting lenders borrow funds, even though there's been no prior act of savings. And so, oh, see, the lower interest rate doesn't correspond to new saving. And so therefore it's just, no. Selgin says, that's not correct. The people who are, when the dust settles, who are holding those extra banknotes in the community on net, they're the ones who provided the real savings, right? Because, you know, how did they acquire on net extra banknotes? Well, they must have done something to earn income. And then when they got paid in those new banknotes, they refrained from consuming. And so if you have a high, you know, an income and your consumption's less, what's that? Well, that's savings. And they just accumulated that savings in the form of adding to their portfolio banknotes issued by those expanding banks. Okay. So that's a very subtle, neat little argument. The only problem is I think it's wrong. Okay, so first, let me say why I think it's wrong, and then I'll quote Mises. All right, so I think it's wrong because go back to just that first example when I was trying to get you to see how could it be that holding a banknote is lending funds to the bank. And I started with a real simple case where someone has a gold coin. He starts out with a gold coin and he goes up to Bank of America and he says, hey, here's my gold coin. I'm depositing it in my checking account, my demand deposit account. And then you give me, you credit my account and now that's in my checking account balance. And so either they could just add it to my balance and I'm walking around with my debit card and my checkbook, or they could give me a note. And as long as I don't spend it, that the fractional reserve banking camp would say I have implicitly lent my gold coin to the bank. And, you could say it's a very short-term loan that I keep rolling over minute after minute if you want, but that's, I think, the way they handle it. And that's why also the bank is allowed to lend it out to somebody else, right? Because it's not a warehouse deposit. It's not like that I'm doing a coat check. They're saying, no, I lent it to the bank, and so the bank can lend it out if it so chooses. It's not violating any contracts or anything like that. And the bank is the intermediary there between me, the lender, and the other borrower. The bank's just an intermediary, all right? And so I want to say, no, that's not correct. Or at least that's where the controversy is. That's where we disagree, the 100% reserve camp. And this is why the earlier thing about the definitions Mises made about money substitutes are so relevant here. That yes, even though that banknote I'm holding is not money proper, it is acceptable in the community as money. That's what makes it a money substitute. And that's the problem, Mises says. That's why the practice of fractional reserve banking has such possible potent effects, is because of this fact that the community tends to treat, or at least in many transactions, treats fiduciary media as being interchangeable with money proper. So because of that, when I deposit my gold coin with the bank and they just credit my account, and so now my account has one more gold ounce in it, I haven't sacrificed anything. I haven't made a loan to the bank. I have not renounced my command over present goods, because to the extent that the community accepts the claim on the bank as being just as good as money proper, I still have a present good. In contrast, if I bought a bank CD, then that would definitely be a loan, right? So if I went up, gave a gold ounce to the bank, and then they gave me a certificate of deposit that said in 12 months' time, the owner of this certificate of deposit can go to Bank of America and receive 1.03 ounces of gold, then that is a one-year loan at a 3% interest rate. Because I can't go to Best Buy and try to buy a TV with a bank CD. Whereas I can go to Best Buy and buy a TV with credits in my checking account, right? Best Buy doesn't view a bank CD as money, whereas they would view ounces of gold in your checking account as money. Just like nowadays, if you have dollars in your checking account, they view that as being as good as green pieces of paper currency, even though those are technically different things, right? When you swipe your debit card, you aren't literally handing over green pieces of paper to Best Buy. Rather, what you're doing is you're saying, right now, Bank of America owes me $100 bills. If I swipe this piece of plastic, legally, I'm transferring it to you. So now Bank of America owes you those green pieces of paper should you decide to claim them. That's different from me literally handing over green pieces of paper. But yet, in practice, because people trust Bank of America to be good for it, that's why Best Buy is happy to accept claims on Bank of America that you transfer over on the same terms as the actual green pieces of paper. All right? And so now let me quote Mises saying the same thing. And I was really happy when I found this. So here is Mises in Theory of Money and Credit, and he says, according to the prevailing opinion, a bank which grants a loan in its own notes plays the part of a credit negotiator between the borrowers and those in whose hands the notes happen to be at any time. Thus, in the last resort, bank credit is not granted by the banks, but by the holders of the notes. Okay, so you see there, this is Mises way back in 1912, anticipating exactly what Selgin's very nuanced, sophisticated position is. Right? That's clearly what Selgin is saying is going on and why fractional reserve free banking is equilibrating in the loan market, again, so long as it happens in a free market, right? If it's fostered by government cartel privileges, then it's not, but that's not what Selgin's talking about, right? And so Mises here is exactly saying the view that Selgin deployed in order to fend off the criticism that issuing fiduciary media could disrupt things because, oh no, the people who end up holding the notes, they're the ones who are implicitly making a loan. That's what Mises just described. And now, if you know Mises' rhetorical style, you realize things don't look good for the free banking camp because this is what he then goes on to say after he talks about some other stuff. And then he comes back to this train of thought and says, now this view by no means describes the essence of the matter. A person who accepts and holds notes grants no credit. He exchanges no present good for a future good. The immediately convertible note of a solvent bank is employable everywhere as a fiduciary medium instead of money in commercial transactions, and nobody draws a distinction between the money and the notes which he holds as cash. The note is a present good just as much as the money. Okay, so Mises there is saying what I was just saying to you a few minutes ago, that somebody who holds an immediately demandable claim on money issued by a bank is not making a loan to the bank. Because what happens when you make a loan is you're renouncing immediate satisfaction for the future. You're giving somebody present purchasing power and they're going to give you purchasing power down the road. You're selling a present good and buying a future good. That's what a loan is. But if instead what you're doing is depositing money into a checking account and you're free to go around town spending that money at will, you're no worse off than if you kept the money in your pocket, right? You haven't renounced present satisfactions at all. In contrast, again, if you bought a CD, then you have, because you can't buy stuff with the CD. You could go sell the CD for money, but you might have suffered a loss if interest rates change in the interim. Okay, so that's the fundamental distinction here. So no, it's not correct to argue that when banks in a free market, free banking, fractional reserve regime issue more notes at a lower interest rate, that ultimately the people who end up holding those notes implicitly lent funds to the borrowers. That's not correct. And last thing I'll do here in this episode is I was trying to come up with a way, like a little thought experiment, to really crystallize this. And here I was expanding on one that Baggus and Howden did in their paper. They had gone through a thought experiment, and then I came up with what I thought Selgin's response would be. So I didn't think they quite hit the mark, or at least I could see why Selgin would think they didn't hit the mark. So then I tried to refine it a little bit. And so here goes. So I'm trying to show you why this view that, oh, no, don't worry. When the banks, because conditions in the community change and people are willing to hold more notes issued by the banks, they can go ahead and do that and issue them through the loan market and push down the rate of interest. And no, don't worry about it, because that's going to be backed up by genuine saving on the part of the community for the people who hold those notes. Don't worry about it. That there's something wrong with that argument. And so this is the thought experiment I came up with. So you've got the community, it's originally in equilibrium. Then all of a sudden, maybe because people are fearful about the future, who knows why, everybody wants to increase his cash balances by 10%. All right. And so normally in this stuff, you assume that really the issue is your real purchasing power, right? It's not that you necessarily want to have 10% more in nominal cash, but the amount of goods and services you can buy in real terms, you want to have go up by 10%. Okay. So if we insist on 100% reserve banking, and let's say it's gold as the money, commodity money, then the people in the Selgin White camp following, Jaeger, they're going to say, oh, that's a problem. Because now the only way to satisfy this demand to increase cash holdings by 10% is a combination of two things. We're going to have to go dig up more gold, and that uses up real resources, you know, to make more gold coins or whatever. And or prices in general have to come down by roughly 10%, right? So if there's no new gold coming in, the only way the community can collectively be holding 10% more in real terms in their cash balances, in terms of, you know, the gold coins, is if prices in general come down about 10%. And so then with the existing amount of gold coins in their pockets, now all of a sudden, everyone's cash balances go that much further at the store. And so now they feel better, And so they don't. And you can see the logic, too, of how that would happen, right? If individuals want to save more to add to their cash balances, they restrict their purchases. That makes prices fall. Because it can't be that everybody can't hold 10% more gold coins if there's no more mining. That's the idea. All right, so just a little thing there about how monetary equilibrium gets restored in these kind of cases. But also, that's problematic, Selgin and White and the people in that camp would say, right? That for a period, the market's not in monetary equilibrium, and it's, you could have problems. You could have that unemployment and stuff like that. If prices are too high, wages are too high, it's wages and prices can be sticky, at least in certain sectors. And so to have to wait for prices to fall, that might have a prolonged period of disequilibrium. And why should we suffer that? Their point is, if instead we had a flexible regime of free banking with fractional reserves, where in a situation like that, the banks just issue more money via the loan market, and then people, if they want to, they can just go and take out a loan from the bank to bolster their cash reserves. So instead of augmenting their holding of money by 10% more in gold coins, they instead augment it with bank notes that say the bearer of this note can get a gold coin at any of these local branches of the banks. And then that's how we restore equilibrium. And so we can do that relatively costlessly, that we don't have to go dig up more gold. It's real cheap to print more banknotes or even just to do it electronically. And everything's fine. And so what I pointed out in my article is that if you just push a little bit here, so again, we just, for the sake of simplicity, we assumed everybody was symmetrical. So it's not that some people borrowed the money or not. It's that every single person, in order to bolster his or her cash reserves, went to the bank and took out a loan such that now his cash holdings were 10% higher. All right. And so now if you say, well, wait a minute, if the interest rate dropped to make that happen, isn't that a problem? And you say, no, because everybody in the community lent himself that money. Right? Because think about it. Everybody in the community now is holding those extra notes that were issued proportionally. And so you would, if you said, okay, this guy here, he borrowed an extra, you know, he originally had 100 ounces of gold and now he just went and borrowed 10 more bank notes that are claim tickets on 10 ounces of gold. So where were the savings to back up this 10 ounces of gold that he just borrowed? Selgin would have to say, oh, it came from him because he himself is holding those 10 bank notes. So he lent himself the 10 banknotes. So to me, that's, you know, and I haven't heard what Selgin's response is to that. Maybe he would say, yeah, so what? You know, I don't know. But to me, that just seems weird that the whole community just all of a sudden increases their cash balances by 10% because each person lent himself the extra money. And that's how he now has 10% more money. That doesn't make any sense to me. But I think that's where you'd have to go if you wanted to take Selgin's position on loan market equilibration. And so to me, that's just another way of seeing that there's something screwy with that analysis, that can't be right. Okay, well, I've gone pretty long here. I'll wrap it up there. There's some other stuff I get into with the history of it where Selgin's pointing to historical examples, and I did some digging, and I think that also it's very awkward at the least for the fraction reserve free banking camp. But I'll leave that to your own discovery. If you go and read it, it's pretty self-explanatory. Thanks for listening, folks, and I'll catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.